economy. Propositions on which, interestingly enough, Kennedy and Johnson's economic advisors gave opposite answers from the answers that have been given by Nixon's economic advisors. And the questions are these. First of all, is monetary policy or is fiscal policy a more powerful tool for demand management? The assumption here is that by managing the level of total overall demand, the government can stabilize economic activity and thereby prevent both inflation and recession. Now, there's a lot of debate about how much the government can do, but if those are the two tools that you could use, which one is more powerful? The second, I assume you all know, maybe agree with you, that fiscal policy means using the government's deficits and surpluses, in other words, using the budget to manage demand, running a deficit in periods when there's a danger of recession, and running a surplus in periods when there's danger of inflation. That's fiscal policy. And that, of course, is done by Congress and the President. Monetary policy doesn't require congressional or presidential intervention. Monetary policy means altering the quantity of money. That would be the total, really, of demand deposits or checking accounts and currency, and probably we'd want to throw in savings deposits in commercial banks, too. The total of these can be managed by the Federal Reserve System, which is a semi-independent agency of the federal government. And it can alter the stock of money, the quantity of money, without any kind of congressional action. In fact, it does it in part without even Congress's knowing what it's doing. It takes a while to figure out. You have to look at what happens to see what the Fed has been doing, because they do operate in secret. And that's monetary policy. Then the second controverted question is, whichever one you think is more powerful, fiscal policy or monetary policy, is it possible to use them to fine-tune the economy? Now, by that I mean, is it possible to use fiscal policy, monetary policy, or demand management so as to get rid of minor, or relatively minor, inflations and recessions? Now, you know, the economy tends to go up and down. Is it possible for the government, through demand management, to smooth off the mountains and fill in the valleys? That's called fine-tuning, and that's debated. And then, third question, given the nature of our economy, the nature of our institutions, big business, labor unions, whatever else you think is important, is it really possible to achieve full employment without inflation in the absence of an income policy? Now, there are two kinds of income policies that we have talked about and tried. What that thing was on. One is guidelines, wage and price guidelines, enforced by jawboning, you know, by moral suasion, where the government says, say for example, government decrees that the old national per man hour productivity is increasing at 3.2% per year. So, workers can have 3.2% per year wage increases. Anything beyond that would be inflationary and is a no-no. And prices can be increased by firms just enough to enable them to pay 3.2% wage increases, and they could cut their prices if they're so profitable that they can pay 3.2% wage increases and their profits would still go up. And that's enforced by nagging. The other form of income policy is price and wage control, where the government somehow comes in and tries to determine what prices and wages shall be, or sets limits to the changes in prices and wages that business and labor unions can affect. All right, now, on these three questions, and with the third question, there are two subparts, the people who were advising Kennedy and Johnson gave quite different answers from the people who were advising Nixon. Nixon's economic advisors, you may remember Walter Heller, for example, or other guy, he was very well known. another guy, Arthur Oaken, Otto Eckstein. These were very prominent advisors in the Kennedy-Johnson administration, and they believed fiscal policy was the tool. Whereas the man who probably was the most important single advisor to Nixon, Milton Friedman, though he's never taken a position in the government, Friedman is the one man identified with the rise of monetary policy in the last 15 or 20 years. The resurgence of interest in monetary policy is largely associated with the name of Milton Friedman. So you got a clear division here. When Nixon came in, monetary policy came in with him. On the next question, can you fine-tune the economy? The Kennedy and Johnson advisors believed you could. And they were arguing very strenuously through Kennedy's administration, and then with some success, with some political success, in 1964, they were arguing that Congress ought to use fiscal policy to fine-tune the economy. And a good number of the arguments that were used to support the 1964 tax cut were arguments made by people who believed in fiscal policy and believed in the possibility of fine-tuning. I happen to doubt that that was why they won. I don't think it was their argument that carried the day. I think we got that tax cut because most people believed taxes were just too damn high. One interesting piece of evidence that I would strongly support that was that a majority of congressmen, when asked whether taxes should be cut, said yes. An overwhelming majority said yes. But when they were asked whether taxes should be cut, if this meant a budget deficit, a slight majority said no. An overwhelming majority of the public, according to a Roper poll or a Gallup poll, I forget now which, said no. So people are always in favor of tax cuts. But this old notion, again, that thou shalt not run a budget deficit is very strong. And quite clearly, if the majority of the public, a large majority of the public, two-thirds of the public, thinks that you should not have budget deficits, well, then clearly the public doesn't believe in fiscal policy as a technique of demand management because it presupposes budget deficits at least part of the time. Then the third question about income policy. Oh, I said that Eckstein, Heller, these guys believed in fine-tuning. Arthur Burns, who, along with Friedman, was the most important continuing counselor of Nixon, had been arguing since the late 1940s that fine-tuning was a pipe dream. And he was the man who Nixon brought with him in 1968 as his chief economic advisor, and whom Nixon very quickly appointed as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors when that position opened up. On an income policy, Kennedy reinstituted something that Eisenhower really started, this business of setting guidelines and then nagging people to behave. But that was a big policy under Kennedy. Walter Heller, again, who was very much of an activist economist, he was a guy who got involved in politics. He didn't just advise the president and stay out of the limelight. He went out and argued for the president's policy. Heller was much of a believer in the effectiveness of guidelines. George Shultz co-edited a book which tries to show that guidelines are a lot of malarkey. And George Shultz was the guy who was now the Secretary of Treasury and who was the author of Nixon's, most people say was the principal author of Nixon's game plan, who was the head of the Office of Budget Management, and who very much had the president's ear from 68 through the present. So here's a guy who's identified with opposition to guidelines, who was one of Nixon's chief advisors. And on the question of price and wage controls, of course, Nixon put them into effect, but as I mentioned yesterday, just 3 weeks before he did so, Paul McCracken, who was the chairman of Nixon's Council of Economic Advisers, published in the Washington Post a brilliant, incisive critique of the whole concept of price and wage controls. And the word is that he published that at Nixon's suggestion. Because you see, there were a lot of Democrats urging price and wage controls, and the word came to McCracken, look, write up something criticizing these guys, write up an answer and get it published in some prominent place. And McCracken went out and did that. And then 3 weeks later, we saw what happened. What did happen? Well, what I concluded yesterday was that the Nixon game plan, which involved the use of monetary policy to cool down the economy, reliance on a minimum of discretionary policy, in other words, you just sort of increase money stock at a steady rate, don't try to fine-tune things, and let things adjust themselves out. This was essentially the Nixon game plan. And then you just cross your fingers and wait until inflationary expectations die, and eventually people will find jobs once again. Those business firms that have cut back production will find something new to do, and they'll start up production again. We'll get back to 3 or 4% unemployment, and the price level will go down to an acceptable rate of increase of maybe 1 or 1.5% per year, which is, many people believe, no inflation at all. When the consumer price index goes up by 1 or 1.5% per year, many people think that simply reflects shifts in the composition of demand, quality changes that the index isn't able to take account of, and so on. So no problem in it. But it didn't work. And why didn't it work? I think that Nixon's advisors would say, and obviously they're not speaking for public consumption at this time, they would say, well, we didn't have enough time. If we had more time, we could have behaved responsibly. But I don't think there's any doubt that Nixon concluded that while his advisors were probably right in the long run, he was going to be reelected or not in the short run, and his policy was not popular. People, the public, did not have any confidence in it. He was being tabbed a do-nothing president, somebody didn't care about unemployment, and so he just threw the advice of his counselors to the winds. He brought in John Connolly, who knows nothing about economics. And that's it. That's where I was yesterday.
That's what I meant to say. Now, up there on the bulletin board says, today is time for questions answered, wickedness condemned, and horoscopes cast. And sometimes I think that economists would be better off to stick to casting horoscopes.
Extraordinary. Can we continue it such a large deficit every year indefinitely?
Yes. Yes, no. What are the effects of a deficit? A lot of people worry about this. Obviously, a deficit causes the national debt to increase. It's very interesting that if anybody would want to take a look at figures on the size of the national debt each year. You all know who believes in deficit finance, and the answer is Democrats, right? Republicans believe in a balanced budget. Let me see if I can find it. Government finance. I have before me figures on the surplus or deficit in every year since 1929. Well, now, I will ignore the war years, huh? Those were unusual. But I look down here from 1946 to the present, and I see, I see some big surpluses in 47, 48, and a surplus in 49. A Democrat. Democrats don't believe in surplus. And then I see, I see a big deficit in 53. That was biggest deficit, $5 billion in the first year that Eisenhower, well, that doesn't really count. That's unfair, I feel, because that's pretty much a legacy from Truman. But now we go down, and we find the biggest peacetime deficit in history, almost $13 billion. Eisenhower did that all by himself. Well, through the 60s, the Democrats were running through the form, running deficits. 61, $3.5 billion, 62, $7 billion, 63, almost $5 billion, 64, almost $6 billion, 1.5 and 65, almost 4 and 66, 8.7 and 67, them dirty Democrats, deficit spenders, aren't they? 1968, $25 billion deficit. Well, that's the Democrats doing. Nixon came in, and by golly, things shaped up. In 1969, we had a $3 billion surplus. Then in 70, $3 billion deficit. In 71, a $23 billion deficit, and in the 72 fiscal year, which is over, it ended 3 weeks ago, we had almost a $40 billion deficit. The deficit that Nixon is planning for 73 is the 73 fiscal year, which runs from July 1st of this year to June 3rd of next year, is $25 billion, and I'll bet he doesn't make it. He'll go higher. So the big additions to the deficit have been run by the presidents who don't believe in deficits. Now, so what? I think the biggest one was $45 billion. But, of course, that was on a much more valuable dollar, so you'd have to adjust the changes in the price on it. We added about $180 billion to the national debt during World War II. And since that time, we've run the national debt up to, it's now about $450 billion. Well, what difference does it make? The most important difference that it makes is that in order to run a deficit, the government has to borrow money. And in the process of borrowing that money, it causes the Fed to create new money, and that's inflationary. So what a deficit is inflationary. It's in effect, there's a limited stock of goods out there, and there's a quantity of dollars just sufficient to buy it. And the government says, we want to buy more goodies. Now, the right thing to do, right in quotes, the traditionally acceptable thing to do, if the government wants more of those goods and services, it takes some money away from the public in the form of taxes so that the government will be able to buy a bigger chunk of it. Well, we don't do that. We don't like that. It's unpopular. What we tend to do now is we simply create more money, and then the government outbids the public, and of course that causes inflation. That is the cause of inflation. If we're willing to accept inflation, we can accept deficits indefinitely. But won't it get so big that it'll bankrupt the country? No. The federal government owes it, and you're bankrupt when your creditors won't hold your debts anymore. And people are quite willing to hold the federal debt. They say, well, won't it come due? Well, when it comes due, the federal government just sells it to somebody else. If you own a $1,000 government security and you want your money, and you come in and say, this bond is mature, give me my money, what the government does is it says, holds it a second, it runs over to the other window, auctions that bond off to somebody else, and at some interest rate, people will be willing to hold it. And in fact, the government is the most secure debtor you can have, because the government has the power, first of all, to collect taxes and send the army in to take the money that it needs to pay off its debts. You know, none of us has that power. And the other thing the government can do, it has the power to print money. So always loan your money to somebody who controls the money supply.
It'll come as that in the form of taxes.
What we are paying in the form of taxes is interest on that debt.
I know, but can't your interest be higher than the income?
Well, the interest on the public debt runs around, I think it's running around 20, I'm not sure, about $20 billion a year. That's a lot.
Yeah.
I could check that, but...
But I mean, couldn't that run more than the income? I mean, the form of tax?
The government takes in, the federal government takes in taxes 10 times that amount.
Yeah, but still it's got to pay services out of those taxes.
Yeah, well, right, I mean... Well, you know,
that's what bothers me. I didn't know anything about it. You know, besides the services, you've got to pay the interest on this money that's being borrowed.
Yeah, but I compare the federal government's position with my own, and when I make that comparison, I find the federal government is being more responsible than I am. I am paying a larger proportion of my income in debt management than the federal government is. Now, that depends on how you calculate things, but, there's nothing wrong with being in debt. It's often wise to go into debt. If the interest charge that you must pay is valued by you as worth less than what you'd have to give up if you didn't borrow and then have to pay this interest, go ahead and borrow. It makes sense. I don't think that there's any real problem here.
I think there are two problems, though, that might influence this thing. One is the It would be nice to create that, knowing that we have forever a expanding those connection products. More people paying in more money in the form of taxes because more people. But with the limiting birth rate that we're not experiencing, and perhaps achieving eventually zero population growth, I think would be the real factor, because eventually the status is going to be over less and less people, and it cannot continue to expand as it has, because if you look back, the population is continuing to increase in the United States, so we have more and more people sharing this debt, more and more people paying the taxes. Now we're going to probably go the other way, at least in 35 years.
Well, but look at something else. I mean, I don't. When I describe this, now I don't want to seem to be approving it because it seems to me to be slightly dishonest. But the federal government, it seems to me, is taking care of this rather nicely. As it increases the debt, it is defrauding the debt holders at a slightly faster rate by causing inflation. You see, at the end of the war, the public debt was about the size of the gross national product. Since that time, the gross national product has increased substantially. A big chunk of that increase has been due to inflation. Inflation caused by the creation of new money, caused by federal expansion of the debt. So the federal government is a very interesting debtor. It is a debtor that has the power to reduce the real burden of its indebtedness by depreciating the money in which those debts are denominated. And it's been doing that. And I would expect it to continue. So that while one of the reasons that the interest charges on the debt have gone up is because holders of the public debt have come to recognize that this is what's happening and have demanded a larger interest rate as a condition of holding the debt. So it seems to me that there's a rough balance here with the maybe any advantage slightly on the side of the federal government. The interest payments have gone up, but the dollar has depreciated slightly faster.
Isn't the government really sort of stealing and borrowing from people with fixed assets, but they're often older people with the inflationary trend?
No, well...
Aren't these the people that are hurt probably the most?
All right, well,
the people will fix
the assets. Yeah, but it's not because the government is borrowing from them. People who are living on pensions with fixed incomes, yeah, they're hurt by inflation more than other people. It's very difficult to decide who's really hurt by inflation. But it isn't the holders of the public debt aren't the people who are most hurt by inflation, probably. For the most part, the debt is held by business firms.
Okay. No, that's not right. No.
Well, deficit spending means ordinarily an increase in the money supply, which means inflation, which means that the dollar is now worth less relative to foreign currency. And if we do not let the dollar depreciate, then we're going to have trouble. What kind of trouble? That all depends. This is another whole big mess in which, incidentally, the federal government and the Nixon administration has not, by and large, gone along with the counsel of those economists whom it has called upon to advise it. The people who are in charge of shaping Nixon's foreign economic policy are strong believers in floating exchange rates. They believe that the rate at which the dollar exchanges for pounds, marks, yen, everything else should be determined by supply and demand. And the government shouldn't be in the business of pegging those exchange rates. And yet Nixon seems determined not to allow a floating dollar. Why? I don't know. I really don't. That's a puzzle. Friend of mine,
is fees involved there, do you think?
I think it is, yeah. You know, I remember several years ago, more than several years ago, it was when Diefenbaker became Prime Minister of Canada when the Conservatives took over. The Canadian dollar was selling at that time, it was floating, and it was selling for about 94 cents American. And one of the things Deacon Baker did was he pegged the Canadian dollar to stop that horrible affront. You know, I mean, that's just crazy. You know, what? But people do think, how many people don't think that when the dollar depreciates, somehow the flag is being dragged in the mire? It is just, to me, it's completely silly. Recently we have been.
How does it affect their view?
Well, there's a special complicating factor in here, and that is it's a factor introduced by the fact that since World War II, the so-called free world, the Western world, has been on a gold dollar standard. Now, what that means is that the United States government, until last year, agreed to peg the dollar at $35 equals 1 ounce of gold. Now, what that meant was that anybody who held gold could sell it to the U.S. Treasury for $35, and anybody who had $35 could sell it to the U.S. Treasury for an ounce of gold. Now, we excluded American citizens from that, and then we gradually excluded all foreigners except for central banks. But that didn't make too much difference, because foreigners could sell the dollars they got to their banks, which would then sell it to the central bank, which was then a legitimate holder and could sell it for dollars. Well, what the system was supposed to work this way, that the U.S., which at the end of World War II owned most of the free world's monetary gold. This is just the U.S. was supposed to peg gold at $35 an ounce. For any foreign holder, all right? And then other countries would peg their currency to the dollar. And in this way, dollars were as good as gold, and the idea was that the world's international reserves would be enormously increased, that countries could use both monetary gold and dollars as reserves. And that worked pretty well until the U.S. started experiencing more inflation, and a lot of other things were happening too, so that more and more dollars began going abroad. And then France was the first one to get angry and said, we don't want to hold all these dollars, and they began demanding gold, and our gold stock went down. And of course, the lower our gold stock went, the less confident these other countries were that we would be able and willing to redeem those dollars in gold, so the more eager they were to quickly cash them before we ran out of gold. And so we promised them, we swear we will never devalue. And oh, there were just all sorts of conferences. And what we did was, before August of last year, we agreed to continue pegging it at that price on condition nobody buys. If anybody starts to buy, then in August 15th, Nixon said we would no longer redeem dollars with gold. Because remember, three times in the speech he said this was to nip those nasty speculators. So we continued with this price, but we weren't selling any. And then in December we agreed to change the price to $38, but with a clear understanding that if anybody tries to buy at that price, we won't sell. Now, we have in effect abandoned the whole standard. But the tricky thing here is that the dollar continues to function as a reserve currency, a very important reserve currency, so that Germany will hold reserves in the form of gold and dollars. And that means everybody has a special interest in what happens to the purchasing power of the dollar. When the U.S. government then runs a deficit, creates more money at home, so that our price level goes up by 5%, that means that a big chunk of the reserves that other countries are holding, on the assumption that their value isn't going to change, that those reserves really are shrinking in value. And they don't like that. It makes them mad. So what they do is they nag us. And they have these big conferences at which the United States catches heck. And I think that is why Nixon appointed Connally as Secretary of the Treasury. because Connolly, being a Texan, is rather thick-headed. He doesn't realize that he's catching heck. I can say that. I think it was Connolly's lack of expertise in this whole area, and his suaveness, his polish, his, you know, his cussedness too. You know, if you get a reasonable man who understands the problem, you can make him feel guilty. But when Connolly would get over there in Brussels or Geneva, one of these big councils, you know, with he would just say, "Look, I don't know what you guys are talking about, but it's your fault."
Are you saying that Nixon hasn't relied on the council of economic advisors to create him?
I think he has. But it seems to me that, after all, he hasn't fired them when Paul McCracken resigned. Well, he did. I think he did act on the basis of their counsel until August 15th. And somewhere between August 1st and August 15th, I don't know how long it takes for a presidential decision to be made, he decided that if he continued to follow their advice, which was probably right in the long run, the long run for him would never arrive, that there'd be a Democratic president in 72. That I was talking to somebody yesterday about Peter Hong. It seems to me that this is one of the fundamental problems with a democracy. By now using democracy here to mean a society in which the government is turned out of office by popular vote every so often. Most people do not have the ability or willingness to wait for long-range goods. They want rather instant results. And a popular political process sort of encourages politicians to play upon the public demand for immediate results. So it seems to me that what we get in this country is policy that looks good in the short run and is potentially disastrous in the long run. And I think that's true whether we're having Democrats or Republicans in power. I mean, there's a tendency to sort of discount the future at an excessively high rate of time pressure.
Now, has there been enough time or enough information yet about the difference between the possible economics of McGovern as opposed to this now, after August 15th at least? Nick, now this is putting you on a real spot, but you're willing to take it, I guess.
Yeah.
He's made a lot of economic pronouncements, you see, in essence.
Not too many.
Well, they're vague, maybe.
Well, we haven't made very many. You know, I mean, every politician says that he's going to stop inflation, get people back to work, get America moving again. And you don't know what that means. The one McGovern proposal has attracted a great deal of attention isn't fundamentally different from Nixon's family assistance plan. Can I say a few words on that idea, which is not radical. I think the economist who has done most to contribute to the popularity of this radical McGovern proposal is Milton Friedman, who was Nixon's chief advisor and was Barry Goldwater's chief advisor. Golly, you don't know who's going to bed with whom. But the problem with all of these schemes, negative income taxes is the term that you should apply to it, is that they run onto one of three shoals. Either what you're trying to do is eliminate poverty. But you're trying to eliminate poverty without destroying work incentives. And there's something else, also without getting ridiculous. Now, what do I mean by that? Like, for example, without putting employed engineers on welfare. Now, let me show you a problem. What you do then is you pick some kind of income. Where's that creature? What you do is you pick some figure. Let's all pick one. How much income? Suppose we decide we are a rich country. We want to abolish poverty. There's no reason anymore why any family should be too poor to have the basic necessities of life. I like that. You like that. Okay. So everybody gets at least $4,000. All right? We just guaranteed everybody that much money, $4,000. Okay. Now we've eliminated poverty. Now, what do we do with the guy who's making $4,100? Does he get, and we say he earned $4,100. Does he get what he earns and no welfare? Whereas the guy who doesn't earn a thing gets $4,000. Hey, you can't do that. What we've done with our welfare programs for a long time is impose upon earned income a 100% tax. Because we give somebody welfare, and if he's able to earn a little income, we take away a dollar of welfare for every dollar of income he earns. And that amounts to a 100% tax on earnings. Well, if you've got a 100% tax on earnings, you don't have much incentive to earn. So what we've got to do, we say, well, what we'll do is, we'll let people, as they earn income, keep some percentage of it. Now, how much? Well, what would you suggest? How much would they have to be able to keep to give them any incentive to work? 50%? Well, at least 50%. All right, let's try 50%. So we'll have a 50% tax break. Now, what's going to happen? If you have a $4,000 base and 50% tax rate, how much income will you? How much income will you have to make before you go off welfare?
Almost six.
Over six. Yeah. Figure out what you
did. You say.
So that means somebody who's making $7,600 a year is on welfare. Now that's about the median income. that's the dilemma you get into. If you eliminate poverty without destroying incentives, you wind up with half the population on welfare, which is ridiculous. If you get most of the population off welfare without destroying incentives, you don't eliminate poverty.
Well, aren't there other examples of how this is attempted in other countries? That they claim to have eliminated at least the maintained at least the survival without having to go begging and so on. And we've had up to 50,000 a month, you know, in Seattle. Have to go to a door or someplace and ask for a sack or two of food, which is a degrading and demeaning thing. And if the churches did it, there was no question that if you went, that was it. While the government has been giving some, now recently in the month, some commodities, but the problem is they want to be sure that the right ones get it. And this is a real dilemma right now between the neighbors in need. Who's going to get it? All these welchers, and all these deadbeats. Well, the actual number of them is very small, very small percentage. But hasn't Sweden done something on this? And don't most of the European countries do something on this? Provide as a necessity without eliminating either incentives or without eliminating this horrible bind of the taxation, which is exceptionally high there, I realize.
Well, I don't know enough about these other countries, but I'm not sure that their experience tells us a whole lot about what we can do. The United States is not like Sweden.
No.
It's much larger, much more variegated. I'd just like to come back to what can we do in the United States? To say, well, Sweden did it, why can't we? I say, okay, Sweden did it, why can't we? Tell me what we can do. I spent a good deal of time working on this question because I supposed to go to a conference once in Indianapolis and provide the answer. I was supposed to be on a panel. Big group of the Child Welfare League of America was having a big conference in Indianapolis, and they wanted four people to come and give them the answer from their perspective, an anthropologist, an economist, a trade union leader, and a social worker.
So I had to work out the answer. It was frustrating. I came up with, by the way. Anybody else is working up? I solved the problem.
I did it
with daycare centers. It seemed to me to be the best way out. Daycare centers that provide good nutrition, good education, health care, sort of the works to try to break the cycle of poverty. But that's a long run thing, you know. And there are problems with that. New York Times Magazine recently had an article suggesting that the problem with America today was that kids weren't getting enough attention from their parents, and all of these crazy reformers like me were running around trying to set up daycare centers. Were really, what we ought to be doing is subsidizing mothers to stay home and take care of their children. So, I don't know.
Is the GNP affected by unemployment?
By unemployment? Most people think unemployment is affected by GNP. GNP and unemployment tend to move together in opposite directions, yeah. But there is no precise negative correlation. It's pretty obvious, isn't it, that the more goods and services we're producing, other things being equal, and they never are, the more people we're going to have at work. Huh? But GNP can go up sharply without much of a sharp increase in employment. And it could go down sharply, though it rarely does. Well, whenever it goes down, there's a decrease in employment. But when it goes up, there isn't always an increase.
Hey, what's so bad about having half the people on welfare?
What's so bad about having them?
Yeah.
Well, the other half don't want them there. The other half don't want them there. Yeah.
I mean, it's basically every distribution thing is what you're dreading out there, and it's a matter of what you call it. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I just don't think it's politically acceptable. I just don't think it's gotten through, and I don't feel, you know, I wouldn't have any cigarettes. I think we're all, I think we all got too much, and the only reason we want more is because other people have more. And I'm sort of an egalitarian at heart. But I must immediately confess that I'm an egalitarian with respect to money, because I derive a good deal of my life satisfaction out of things that money doesn't buy. You know, and that's important to remember. People who have a good education, who've had a lot of just life chances. You know, a college student living in a garret is not poor. But a college student living in an attic somewhere is not necessarily poor. An artist living in the
reason why this can't mean this can take something that we can't take. You know, like our gal went home to Denmark to find their tax instead of 47% is now going to be 55. You know, well, this is an ordinary income, average teacher's income, which is a smaller base than the other professions. But then their satisfaction is so large. I mean, this is the thing. So easy to get to whatever the sources of renewal are. A good discussion, a hike off the mountain for the Norwegians and the Swedes, any kind of boat on the water. So the other guy's getting handouts in the state, and you aren't, well, you care. And this sort of a feeling. I remember Mary's father using the illustration of that, he said, Bob, he's a rather wealthy person, because he always got first class for nothing going across the ocean whenever he went over. And he said, why do you always put up with these dreadful taxes? And he says, oh, you unfortunate capitalists over there in America, you people in North Carolina would get nowhere if we didn't, you know, because I always take care of our brother. And you ought to have telephone and electricity too, and we're going to pay the difference in taxes. Well, that's one thing, it's just because their environments are hostile and the health that they live with it. But, in Denmark, everybody's living in the same lovely little land, but an awful lot of them have to be getting decreased to make a tax set up 55%.
Is it really true, though, that the people in those countries don't want material overseas and those countries? In many countries throughout the world, they've been underprivileged and neglected. I think, for example, that Japan, the 20th century, that they're becoming exposed to goods and services being demanded and increasing and extremely
expensive. Do you think they demand it like we do, though?
Not like we do, but they've been exposed to it.
Yeah. I mean, they aren't propaganda, it's a constant advertising to help our demand. done to try and stimulate, again, people that desire things they don't can't supply them. But that would back up if I can't say.
That suggests that advertising may not be all that effective. We like to think, and I think we're mistaken in this, we like to think that this demand for goods is really the result of advertising. And I'm sure advertising plays a role, but I don't think it's commercial advertising that is fundamentally responsible for this. I got to see my neighbor get it.
Right. Yeah. A lot of times, that the Mormon Church take care of all roads, you don't have this problem on
Wednesday. Bye. You can get all the Lutheran churches to tithe. Everybody who's a Lutheran who has so much money can do a whole lot.
Yeah. Well, also the Mormons, they don't have any fun.
But unfortunately, the Lutherans just take care of Lutherans because the Mormons just take care of the Mormons.
If the Lutherans would stop drinking and smoking and
brown bread and
what were you saying?
Well, we want to maintain democracy, and we can have full employment.
Yeah. Right. We do not want full employment at whatever cost. But we don't want full employment, really. What we want is for everybody to be able to find a decent job within a reasonable period of time, as long as he's reasonable in his expectations. And there's a lot of weasel words in there. But, yeah.
I think we want more for our services than what it should be in terms of wages.
Well, we all want more.
Yeah. That's bad, too.
Does anybody make some economic advice? Does everybody think in terms of kind of welfare for the rich? You know, the tax break somebody gets if they have a big house and it's a write-off on their income tax and such a thing?
Yes. Yeah.
What do they do about that?
Well, they make proposals to change it and nothing happens. Because yeah, I think you're right. Gee, you know, golly, I pay a fantastic amount of interest every year, which for some weird reason can be deducted from my income tax. There's no logic to it that I can discover. But I appreciate it, and I accept it gladly. I would also vote to change it, but most people wouldn't. I'll tell you one of the things that's behind this. It is the old myth of every American a homeowner. The biggest chunk of interest that people expect to pay in their lifetimes is interest on that mortgage. And the idea is that by allowing people to deduct interest from their income tax, you subsidize homeownership, and America is built on homeownership. I think that's kind of silly.
Well, the larger the home, the larger the bank, and the larger the income tax is.
But we shouldn't say this, though, because of the churchgoers, probably if we start looking at loopholes, the biggest one is having church property not taxed. If your church catches fire, your local fire department comes and puts it out.